Welcome to another edition of Time Suck Short Sucks. I'm Dan Cummins, and today I will be sharing the story of the Crescent Hotel horrors, from Healing Springs to hauntings. Being that it's October, I've decided to do some horror-related short sucks this month, topics that you might find on the Scared to Death podcast instead of here on Time Suck. And if you listen to Scared to Death, you may recall that we did tell the story of the Crescent Hotel way back in early 2020, episode 35, Crescent Hotel Horrors. I remember thinking then that there was enough real-world, documented horror that took place at this hotel and enough strange shit that occurred in the hotel's town of Eureka Springs that we could also do an episode of Time Suck about it, at least a short one. So, here we are. If you're a connoisseur of haunted places, it's likely, even if you don't listen to Scared to Death, that you've already heard of the Crescent Hotel. The stories of supposed sightings are many, and the backstory to the alleged ghosts is intense. Opened in the little town of Eureka Springs, Arkansas in 1886, when the Berg had almost 4,000 people living in it, almost twice as many as today, the once fabulous Crescent Hotel didn't initially look like it would ever become known primarily for darkness, decay, and spectral figures lurking in its halls. Quite the opposite. The magnificent structure, with its high ceilings, chandeliers, and modern, for the time, miracles like electricity and hot and cold running water, was intended to be a place where people could relax in splendor, where they might dine in the hotel's restaurant after a long day of horseback riding, walking on carefully manicured paths, or playing croquet in the gardens. Maybe if these people were travelers seeking some kind of medical miracle, as they often were, they might often spend some of their time taking a dip or a refreshing bath in Eureka's eponymous springs, famous waters that supposedly held healing powers. Indeed, it was these healing waters that set off a tourism boom to the newly founded city in the 1880s, an explosion in visitors, some of whom would stay in hotels like the Crescent, others who might simply erect shacks near the water and hope that whatever ailment they had come with would be gone by the time they left. But instead of the face of the town's wellness industry, the Crescent Hotel became something else entirely. After a stint as a school for girls and another as a hospital run by a conniving fraudster, many have wondered if the history of the Crescent Hotel has left more than just physical reminders of the past. They wonder, does something roam the halls of the once stately property? And if they venture inside, will they encounter it?
Words and ideas can change the world.
I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother.
I have a dream.
I'll plead not guilty right now.
Your only chance is to leave with us.
Let's start, as we often do here, with some history. Have you ever been to Arkansas? Tucked between Missouri, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, and Tennessee, Arkansas is America's 25th state, entered into the Union on June 15, 1836. And of course, people have lived in the land now known as Arkansas for long before that. The hills and valleys of northwestern Arkansas, the focus of our episode today, are the ancestral lands of the historic Osage Nation. And bands of Delaware and Shawnee peoples have also lived in the area. The Quapaw people, part of the Osage Nation, were called the Arkansas, meaning South Wind people, in Algonquian, a family of about 30 languages spoken by various Native American tribes. Some sources say that Native American legends tell of a great healing spring in the Eureka Springs area. We don't know how long people have dipped their bodies into its supposedly healing waters, but perhaps for hundreds, if not 1,000 or more years. And maybe it has made some people feel better. Probably has. We know now that mineral springs and hot springs, they can't actually cure an illness. You're not going to suddenly no longer have, you know, lung cancer or AIDS after soaking in a spring, unfortunately. But regular soaking can provide a variety of health benefits, including muscle pain relief, skin condition improvement like eczema and psoriasis, reduced stress, potentially boosted circulation, things like that. And the minerals in some springs, such as magnesium and sulfur, combined with the heat and buoyancy, can support the body's natural healing processes and promote overall wellness. So, doesn't cure, but does help. And if you've ever soaked in a mountain spring, you know that it just feels good. Back to Arkansas's history of settlement. The very first Europeans in Arkansas were Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto and the men under his employ, when he led an expedition into the territory way back in 1541. After finding nothing he considered of exceptional value and encountering native resistance the entire way, He and his men returned to the Mississippi River, where DeSoto fell ill and died in May of 1542, while his men proceeded to Mexico. DeSoto was followed by French explorers Jacques Marquette and Louis Joliet over a century later in 1673, opening up a century and a half of French exploration and commerce. But early European colonization of the area, pretty spotty, mostly accidental. The French were focusing on the better-known and better-mapped regions of portions of present-day Texas and Louisiana. By the end of the 17th century, French missionaries began to follow in these explorers' footsteps, congregating around the Arkansas Post, a place established near Lake Diamond in 1686, a military outpost. Few missionaries actually stayed in Arkansas, and the ones who did were often killed by the indigenous Quapaw and another group, the Corowa. For much of the first half of the 1700s, the Arkansas Post, the first European settlement in Arkansas that had been built about 35 miles upriver from the strategically significant confluence of the Arkansas River with the Mississippi River, will be taken down and reestablished, depending on where missionaries or traders found it advantageous to have a base. In 1721, Scotsman John Law and his company of the West, a joint stock company, acquired control of the colony of Louisiana, then stretching over the entire Mississippi River Valley via a charter granted by the King of France, Louis XV. The charter required the company to recruit colonists and to grant land to individuals for the establishment of concessions or plantations, and John Law himself received one of the largest concessions located on the Arkansas River. By the end of the 1720s, 47 habitants resided there, so it didn't exactly explode in population. A storekeeper, a surgeon, an apothecary, a military garrison led by a commandant, plus a handful of indentured servants, and six African-American slaves. However, Law would go bankrupt. Most of the people who had come with him had to pivot and become hunters and traders if they wanted to remain in the area. Throughout the 18th century, the vast majority of the European population of Arkansas, a very small population of just a few hundred people, was engaged in hunting or the fur and skin trade as trading post managers, hired hands, and hunters. The French and the Quapaw hunted and traded for bear oil, tallow, buffalo meat, skins, you know, all the stuff you find at the grocery store today, shipped them down the river to New Orleans. This produced an interesting cultural mixing because in addition to the French from France, French Canadians started coming down as well, finding it much easier to make a living by hunting and fur trading in the abundant Ozarks than farming in the much colder climate and short growing seasons in Canada. In the last two decades of the 18th century, a few farming families, more French from the Illinois country, plus Anglo-Americans and German Protestants mixed, arrived. Them and some military officers stationed at that Arkansas post were the main European inhabitants, and the officers were considered to be the center of the area's very tiny upper class, as they were well-educated. Arkansas, along with all of the Louisiana territory, passed into Spanish hands in November of 1762, but the Spanish wouldn't influence the culture or settlement of Arkansas very much. It was largely ignored. That Arkansas post, founded by the French, became a small Spanish outpost now and was moved upriver to a more defensible location, served as a hub for the area's fur traders, who were still mostly French, and provided supplies for travelers and housed a very small military contingent. The Louisiana Territory would switch hands a couple more times, first when it returned to French control in 1800 in exchange for a kingdom in Italy. France would then sell the Louisiana Territory to the U.S. famously in 1803 for the paltry sum of $15 million, or approximately one or two houses in the Hamptons today. Obviously, $50 million went a lot further back then than it does now, but this was still a steal of a deal. For the most part, however, for those living on the ground, life was defined not by which Europeans or Americans were in charge, but by remote hunting, fishing, and trading. Very, very rural, pretty quiet life. Three French families managed to make it big in agriculture, one of which built the first flour mill in Arkansas, and five German Protestant families also became quite prosperous, but by and large, the state remained extremely rural and undeveloped. Historian Morris Arnold believes that, quote, there were never more than 8 or 10 real farmers at any one time near the Arkansas post in the colonial period. So yeah, again, very rural. Moving along now to the beginning of the 19th century and some of the first decades of American independence, The first order of business for the newly founded U.S., which had been repressed for decades by Great Britain, was, you know, to repress someone else. The way of the world, for most of the world's history. The U.S. government was able to strong-arm the Osage into ceding northern Arkansas in a 1825 treaty. After that, the land was open to white settlers, but Eureka Springs, where our story takes place today, remained sparsely populated until after the Civil War. And when it did see an influx of visitors, it was supposedly mostly because of one man, Dr. Alva Jackson. Jackson's story doesn't have a lot of physical evidence behind it, but it's been reprinted in enough articles on the area that it is definitely worth including, probably happened. Alva Jackson, born on July 26, 1806, down in Georgia, would be credited with finding Eureka Springs' major spring, Basin Spring. At least he was the one who found it for us white folk. And in 1856, claimed that the waters from that spring had cured his eye ailments. Not sure what kind of eye ailments he had. Guessing he had glaucoma, maybe some sight problems, you know, some vision problems. Eye ailments is a fucking weird way to describe that, though. It sounds super gross to me. Like his eyeballs were just covered in warts. This is alien eyes. Or like blood and pus just constantly seeping out of his fucking nasty eyeballs. May none of us ever suffer from those kinds of eye ailments. According to some sources, Jackson had established a hospital in a local cave during the Civil War in the area called Dr. Jackson's Cave Hospital, and he'd used the waters from Basin Springs to treat his patients there, claiming he'd learned his techniques from Native Americans. Dr. Jackson's Cave Hospital. That sounds like a fucking comedy sketch. I know it was a very different time, but I'm not sure I would feel good about going to a fucking cave hospital, even back in the 1860s. I feel like a cave hospital is where you go to be treated for things that no one suffers from anymore. Like you go there to get your rickets or your scurvy cleared up. You know, maybe you got some plague. You got stricken with a little bit of leprosy. You need to take a trip to the cave hospital, see the cave doctor. May we never suffer from eye ailments. May we never be taken to be treated in cave hospitals where we will definitely die. After the war, Jackson marketed the spring waters as Dr. Jackson's Eye Water. That is a weird fucking product. If that was on the shelf today, I don't know that would be a real hot seller, getting old Dr. Jackson's Eye Water. The hell was going on with people's eyes back then? A lot of eye ailments. Jackson did not, of course, come up with the notion of magical water that can cure your fucking eyeballs or whatever else ails you. His eye water was just another iteration of something called healing waters, a health idea that's existed long before him, and one we still have around today. Today, places with supposedly healing waters are typically marketed as spas, and spas have actually been around for a bit. There were spas in colonial America, but they didn't really become very popular until the mid-19th century, when nationwide prosperity outside of the Civil War years filled many with a desire to travel. A growing interest in the healing arts and faith cures, some would say phony miracle cures or quackery, I would be one of those people. Coupled with increasingly affordable railway fares caused people, especially the well-to-do, to flock to natural settings like the Ozark Mountains Springfield Plateau. Get some healing waters. This geologic layer contains large areas of limestone and dolomite. Soluble limestone made mostly of calcium carbonate and dolostone made mostly up of the mineral dolomite are sedimentary rocks that dissolve in water containing dissolved carbon dioxide, and that leads directly to a landscape characterized by caves, sinkholes, other unique geological features like springs. Rain passes through the ground, you know, the porous ground in areas like this, continues down to a level called the zone of saturation. The zone is a place where water completely fills every opening in and around rock and soil, similar to how, you know, water fills the empty spaces in like a bowl full of marbles. You know how you fill up bowls of marbles all the time? That's a pretty good analogy, right? The upper surface of this zone is called the water table. Below are aquifers, bodies of saturated rock through which water passes easily. Springs can form on hillsides where a water table, an aquifer, or a water-filled underground passageway runs into the slope of the land. Gravity causes the water to flow out and down the hillside. One really cool thing about these springs is that they generally produce fresh water throughout all this that is typically pretty perfect for drinking without needing to be, you know, like boiled or treated. Hence the names of water brands today like Poland Springs, right? This association still holds. Spring water is good, healthy water. And it actually generally is especially good because a lot of springs have a high mineral content, the result of the water dissolving through the rock that I mentioned as it, you know, passes through. For instance, limestone dissolves into calcium carbonate, while dolomite dissolves into calcium magnesium carbonate. Minerals can color and flavor the water, or in the case of sulfur, make it really fucking stink. Some minerals create carbon dioxide bubbles, making the water naturally fizzy, which is pretty cool. And all of this looked to a population that was still more superstitious than we are today, like, you know, magic, natural magic, coupled with the fact that relaxing in a hot springs can make you feel pretty damn good, as can getting a massage, eating some fresh food, right? Now you got a recipe for a brand new health fad. Have some juice, sit in the springs, have a nice dinner in your hotel, you know, room, or whatever. Why did I say room? Restaurant? Or room. You can have room service. Indeed, mineral water promoters, people who made spa-like businesses near these springs, made fantastic sweeping claims back in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Springs were said to alleviate or cure a wide range of illnesses, including rheumatism, catarrh, and inflammation of mucous membranes, tuberculosis, hay fever, diabetes is quite the range of things. Dyspepsia is a form of indigestion, asthma, jaundice, malaria, paralysis. Okay. Neuralgia, aka intense nerve pain, gout, cancer, dropsy. You know how we're all fucking worried about having dropsy? It's excess fluid in tissues or body cavities, and the ever vague and pretty dismissive female troubles. Got to get your female troubles solved. Does your lady suffer from female troubles? Tell her to soak that stinky old sourpuss in Eureka Springs and say goodbye to hysteria. That comes from one of the old pamphlets marketing this place. It doesn't, but I feel like it could have. I imagine, you know, real ads from the time shared a similar tone. The earliest, most popular health resort in America was in Saratoga Springs, New York, beginning in the early 1800s. In Arkansas, the location of that spring-heavy Springfield Plateau, the first bathhouse at Hot Springs, Arkansas, built back in 1830. And soon Eureka Springs, nearly 200 miles north of Arkansas, of Hot Springs, Arkansas, up near the Missouri border, would see the same kind of business. And why did people flock there instead of just having some of that sweet Dr. Jackson's eye water sent to them, retrieved for them? Well, because it was one thing to buy Jackson's eye cure, just like we might buy a bottle of lotion at a hotel spa or some goop product just to try it out. But if you're really serious about getting better, you had to go there. At least that was the prevailing thought. You see, for many of us humans, for quite some time, our experience of health, for better or for worse, has often been thought of as a pilgrimage or as a journey. Something that will probably sound familiar to anyone who's cruised Instagram recently, seen a post about somebody's health journey or recovery journey, right? Sometimes a journey is metaphorical, sometimes just like a process getting better, not an actual physical trip, but it is still common for people to take physical journeys as well. Like the many people who go to health spas, retreats, other places where they envision becoming the best version of themselves. You know, in other words, they don't just want a product, they want an experience, something that will transform them inside and out. The way people have imagined pilgrimages to holy sites or heading to the jungle for an ayahuasca trip as being able to purify them, restore them, provide them with some kind of rebirth, heal them, of course. And soon the Basin Spring area would find its first true pilgrim. This was Judge Levi Best Saunders of nearby Berryville, who tried Jackson's spring water, either for an eye disease or for a skin disease. A lot of eyeball problems back then. There's two stories. And after he was healed, either by the water or he just coincidentally got better, he set up a camp in the area. Following Saunders' lead, 20 more families set up camps nearby to cure what ailed them. And in this way, a settlement was born. Saunders' son, Buck, reportedly suggested that they call the settlement Eureka after explorer Ponce de Leon, who famously exclaimed, "Eureka!" after finding the Fountain of Youth, even though he did not do that for sure. Didn't even look for it, didn't say that. It's actually now believed by most historians that Ponce de Leon never searched for the Fountain of Youth, never believed in the existence of the Fountain of Youth. All that Fountain of Youth talk began after his death, part of a smear campaign by rivals to make him look like an idiot. Back to Arkansas, the city of Eureka Springs was formally founded on July 4th, 1879, when Saunders built that the first house, and more people arrived every day now to take advantage of these springs. And then it was officially incorporated the following year. Soon, similar towns across the region would pop up as Eureka's immediate fame and fast-paced prosperity caught the eye of several other communities also blessed with mineral springs. Over in Benton County, speculators in Cherokee City moved to nearby El Dorado after Cherokee City's prospects went bust after 1882. And when much El Dorado washed away during a flood a year or two later, many of those same entrepreneurs now moved to the newly booming town of Siloam Springs. The success of these communities, whether they lived or died, generally depended on transportation back then. For instance, when Siloam Springs began touting its waters and building hotels in the early 1880s, it was banking on the likelihood of a railroad coming through. The town's population quickly swelled, only to then drop when the railroad did not show up. But then after the Kansas City, Pittsburgh, and Gulf Railroad finally did steam into town in 1893, the population popped up again. And once again, businesses attempted to capitalize on it. To help convince the public of a spring's health benefits, the town created a big spectacle where a water sample was analyzed and the results advertised with the claim that certain springs could cure specific ailments. This is all bullshit. These claims were reprinted in newspaper stories, advertisements, souvenir photographs, testimonials from satisfied patients, often just lies, people paid to lie, were sent to newspapers all around the country in an effort to lure in health seekers. Rivalries developed between spring communities. For example, an 1880 letter in the Fayetteville Democrat noted that the countryside around Siloam Springs was much more attractive than the other shitty springs. Not happy about Siloam Springs being singled out as the best spring in the area to visit, in 1882 edition of the Harrison Times, or in it, one writer quipped, "The water in the courthouse well is either developing remarkable medicinal qualities or else there's a dead cat in it." I.e. the water in Siloam Springs stunk and was shitty. Speaking of dead things, in 1880, the Eureka Springs baby made headlines as the discovery of a supposedly fossilized child. This hoax, though it would not be identified as a hoax until 1948, was the brainchild of Henry Johnson, a Scottsville merchant who modeled his deception after the Cardiff Giant, another hoax. That massive stone man was supposedly discovered in 1869 in Cardiff, New York, publicly acknowledged as a hoax the following year in a lawsuit that pitted its originator against showman P.T. Barnum. I believe we talked about that in the P.T. Barnum Times Like episode. Henry Johnson thought he could craft an even better hoax, and he would, actually. He hired his relative, Marcus Lafayette Kelly, a Fayetteville tombstone carver, to create an 85-pound, 26-inch-long statue of a child, which was then encased in a thick coating of clay and ash. Around the time it was being carved, Thomas Campbell and J.B. Hallam of Texas arrived in Eureka Springs. Hallam bought a piece of land near town, hired Campbell to dig a well on it. On October 1st, Campbell, working alone, supposedly just dug up this baby at a depth of 4 feet. Huh. With Eureka being a spa town, many people who lived there, well, passing the time until they felt better. They were eager to see whatever this new thing was. Johnson, who established his claim by supposedly buying a share in the baby's ownership, Hallam and Campbell charged 10 cents to view the find, later raising the rate to 35 cents. And after seeing it, locals were immediately convinced of the ancient child relic, calling it proof of pre-Adamic generations, predicting that it would revolutionize geology. And of course, this brings a bunch of tourism to the town, so everybody in town loves it, and there's more spring money being made. Others would express doubts. Most telling of all was the Arkansas Gazette, which opined of the, quote, petrified Indian baby, that, quote, there has never been such a thing before. Indian blood was never claimed for the Cardiff Giant. Nevertheless, the excitement caught on, and within a year, the carving, known variously as the Eureka Baby or the Petrified Indian Baby or as a Hindu idol, okay, had been exhibited in St. Louis, Missouri, Galveston, Texas, and New Orleans, Louisiana. A money-making tour launched by a new group of investors who bought out the original grifters for a reported $4,600. And they all got away with it. Only in 1948, after all the participants were dead, did T.J. Robotham give an interview to the Arkansas Democrat, revealing the connections between the participants. Robotham's brother John lived in Eureka Springs in 1880, rented a room to Harry Johnson. Hallam was the Robotham's brother-in-law and lived nearby. All the guys knew each other and conspired together. Campbell surely knew Johnson back in Pope County because he used Johnson's business partner as a character witness when making a sworn statement concerning his find. T.J. Robotham had revealed that Johnson and Kelly were related by marriage. Anyway, all kinds of stuff going on with these rivalries. While that was happening, others were trying to make money in Eureka through more legitimate ventures. O.D. Thornton built the first general store in 1879. Captain Joseph Perry, owner of numerous hotels across the U.S., built a four-story hotel called the Perry House in 1881. Although the official city population remained just under 4,000 people, thousands more came to Eureka Springs, the area, set up temporary housing, often small wooden shacks on the hillside surrounding the 62 springs of the area. Funnily enough, the tourism boom caused some confusion because apparently few of these people knew how to pronounce the name of the state in which they were vacationing. In 1881, the Arkansas General Assembly passed Arkansas Code 14105. Whereas confusion of practice has arisen in the pronunciation of the name of our state, and it is deemed important that the true pronunciation should be determined for use in oral official proceedings. And whereas the matter has been thoroughly investigated by the State Historical Society and the Eclectic Society of Little Rock, which have agreed upon the correct pronunciation as derived from history and the early usage of the American immigrants. Be it therefore resolved by both houses of the General Assembly that the only true pronunciation of the name of the state, in the opinion of this body, is that received by the French from the native Indians and committed to writing in the French word representing the sound. It should be pronounced in three syllables with the final S silent, the A in each syllable with the Italian sound, and an accent on the first and last syllables. The pronunciation with the accent on the second syllable with the sound of A in man and the sounding of the terminal S is an innovation to be discouraged. Funny that they had to pass a law on how to fucking say Arkansas. Tourists weren't the only ones setting up shop in Eureka or Eureka Springs. Freed during the Civil War, a number of African-American families began establishing homes in the Eureka Springs area, though they would be banned from all springs except for Spring Harding, because a lot of people born into any given generation are as hateful as they are fucking dumb. I want that sentiment to be shared in history classes going forward. Can we do that? Just taught to all students of all ages, even preschoolers. Mr. Cummins, why were African Americans forced to use different drinking fountains? Well, Ted, because a lot of people born into any given generation are as hateful as they are fucking dumb. Anyway, due to the sudden influx of people, former Arkansas Governor Powell Clayton founded the Eureka Improvement Company to take advantage of new economic opportunities in the city, hoping to extend it into a retirement community for the wealthy. And one property of the Improvement Company would open its doors in 1886, the Crescent Hotel. Before we now properly explore this episode's actual subject, time for this week's First to Two Mid-Show sponsor breaks. If you don't want to hear these ads, please sign up to be a Space Lizard on Patreon, get this catalog ad-free, get these episodes early, and more. Thanks for listening to those ads, and now let's check in and check out the Crescent Hotel. The construction of the Crescent Hotel would be quite the feat. Isaac L. Taylor, a well-known architect from St. Louis, was enlisted to design the hotel. Taylor was known for his expertise in creating grand, elegant structures, and the hotel, a palace made from local limestone, would be exactly that. Work began in 1884 and included a large workforce, skilled stonemasons, carpenters, and artisans. Finally, on May 20th, 1886, the big building opened to great fanfare. Newspapers around the nation heralded it, quote, the most luxurious resort in America. And its opening day featured music, dancing, and banquets. Indeed, anyone coming there would be impressed. The hotel had electric lights a full three decades before electricity became commonplace in about half of America's homes. Almost nobody had electricity back in 1886. It had a hydraulic elevator, something else that many visitors would experience for the first time there. Its bathrooms featured both hot and cold running water, something that did not become standard in American homes until after World War II. It had high archways, spired roofs, turrets, and an architectural style that beautifully blended Gothic and Romanesque traditions. These were sights that people from the more prosperous East Coast might have already seen, but in the rugged Ozarks, the towering hotel with its rich hardwood, intricate moldings, crystal chandeliers seemed like nothing short of a miracle. One guest wrote that it was, quote, a sanctum of elegance and comfort, unlike anything I've ever seen in the Ozarks. Surrounding the hotel were terraced gardens, meandering pathways, you know, perfectly manicured fountains, gazebos, a covered pavilion for outdoor dining and leisure. Unsurprisingly, all these features drew a wealthy clientele, successful businessmen, politicians, well-known celebrities who eagerly participated in the hotel curated activities such as horseback riding, lawn tennis, croquet, as well as nightly dances. And of course, its main draw was its wellness program. Spa treatments and healing mineral baths conducted in ornate bathhouses. It was incredible. The heyday of the Crescent was remarkable. It's fun to imagine all the smiles and laughter and flirting that must have went down in its bars and restaurants, all the memories built inside its rooms. But then, as the Crescent entered the 20th century, things began to change. The wave of enthusiasm for the spring's healing powers ended as scientific advancement began to create, well, actually real medicine. And government regulations began to build up protections against quackery. The Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906 was designed to protect consumers from dangerous ingredients and false advertising. And unfortunately for Eureka Springs and the Crescent Hotel, it included regulations regarding how mineral water specifically could be promoted. And the way the Crescent had been advertising itself was no longer legal. And instead of being viewed as a prestigious destination, it was now seen as a bunch of quackery supported by fools. Just 2 years after the Pure Food and Drug Act was passed, in 1908, the hotel closed its doors as a resort. Fortunately for the building's owners, the same year, it would find new life, this time as the Crescent College and Conservatory for Young Women, a private school that catered to the daughters of affluent families. The architecture was already in place to give the school an aura of refinement and culture. Classrooms were set up in former guest rooms, while the ballroom was converted into a lecture hall. It was a pretty smooth transition. And also the beginning of the building's association with the paranormal. A bunch of young women on their own for the first time, equally scared and thrilled by their new independence, led to the Crescent Hotel's first reports of ghost sightings, such as one in a letter from 1911, when a student described an experience, writing, quote, "The long corridors seemed to whisper secrets of the past, and some nights I could swear I heard the sound of footsteps when no one should be." Apparently it didn't occur to this girl that what she might have been hearing was another girl sneaking out of her fucking room. Sadly, the new school did not last that long. In 1924, the Crescent College closed its doors. And now the still modern and still luxurious building entered a prolonged period of neglect. The ground sat vacant, the grand halls and gardens slowly succumbing to weeds and decay. And also now, some townspeople claim to see lights flickering in the windows at night, to hear faint sounds emanating from the empty building. Ghosts? Or was the building now a great place to squat and or party and hook up? Probably the latter. As the hotel entered the 1930s, but we don't know, it stood as a relic of a bygone era, a time of prosperity and excitement for the natural world that few could remember as the country now slid into the hardscrabble times of the Great Depression. And relying on the land became less of a luxury and more of a necessity. And of course, seeing something fall from grace, from prosperity to decay, is a reminder of our own mortality as humans and the end we will all meet someday. And as a result, stories of hauntings at the Crescent Hotel continued to circulate around the town of Eureka Springs. And then the hotel's next owner would cement the idea that something dark was happening inside those limestone walls. Because now it really would be. And before we explore the dark chapter of the Crescent Hotel that led to paranormal infamy, time for today's second of two mid-show sponsor breaks. Thanks for listening to those sponsors. And now, who is the new strange and terrible owner of the former Crescent Hotel? In 1937, the hotel was purchased by a man who would transform the luxury resort. His name was Norman G. Baker. And in the long tradition of Eureka Springs, he was a healer, kind of. Also in the long tradition of Eureka Springs, he was a grifter, a fraud, a dangerous grifter, the most dangerous the town would ever see. He was born in 1882 in Muscatine, Iowa, got his start as a radio personality, inventor, showman, bullshitter, mostly a bullshitter. First working as a touring vaudeville performer, Baker returned to Muscatine in 1941 to market his patented air calliophone. Oh, fun, a portable calliope. For carnivals, outdoor advertisers, you know, just overall calliope enthusiasts. Would you like to hear what this thing sounds like? Of course you would. Everybody loves the calliophone. Oh, that's nice. Yeah, Bev, go, Bev, go! Fucking killing it. You just... You just listened to the incomparable Bev Smitley. Smitley, probably. It's Smitley. I'm just joking around. Everybody knows Bev Smitley. Bringing her Caliphone talents to the Wells County, Indiana Historical Museum Ice Cream Social back in June of 2010 there. Anyway, Baker's bustling Caliphone operation soon expanded into a mail-order business, peddling everything from overalls to coffee. Baker even promoted an art correspondence school, despite his confession that he, quote, couldn't paint to save his life. So he just, you know, he's figuring out that, you know, people will buy anything he feels like selling them, I guess. Next, observing Henry Field's use of the radio to sell seeds in Shenandoah, Iowa, Baker constructed his own radio station and started broadcasting in 1925. With his lineup of live music, agricultural reports, and Baker's own colorful broadcasts, KTNT, Know the Naked Truth, became a popular station amongst rural Midwesterners, many of whom flocked to Muscatine on summer Sundays to picnic outside the KTNT studio, enjoy the carnivalesque atmosphere, and see Baker clad in his trademark white suit with a lavender tie. Dude even dressed like a grifter. Baker gained further clout when he broadcast on behalf of Herbert Hoover's 1928 presidential campaign. Hoover, of course, would go on to be one of the worst presidents of all time. 1929, Baker's tabloid magazine, TNT, Know the Truth. He's really fucking going hard on that Know the Truth thing. Published a sensational story touting an unconventional cancer treatment. And it was unconventional because it definitely didn't work. Months later, Baker will open his own cancer hospital in Muscatine, staffed by a collection of chiropractors, naturopaths, and diploma mill MDs. So that's cool. You can never have enough chiropractors working at a fucking cancer hospital, right? We all know the connection between cancer and chiropractors. Former employee later testified that Baker's panacea, or cure-all remedy, was nothing more than a mixture of clover, corn silk, watermelon seeds, and water. That motherfucker. Making money off of giving false hope to the sick and the dying. And that money was good. It was very good. With aggressive advertising, Baker's hospital, that sounded about as legit as that fucking cave hospital I mentioned earlier, accrued monthly revenues topping $75,000 in 1931, over $1.5 million a month in today's money. Although lacking any medical training, Baker himself began directing patients' treatments, and he warned the public of the dangers of vaccinations, aluminum utensils, and greedy mainstream physicians. Thank God we don't have people like that around anymore, right? Right? Wink, wink. During the spring of 1931, Baker's crusade against preventive medicine, preventative medicine, even helped to incite a rebellion in eastern Iowa, known as the Iowa Cow War. And that's a real thing that happened. Too much to really get into here, but also too interesting to ignore. Baker's broadcast and editorials encourage farmers to resist state veterinarians' efforts, their evil efforts, to enforce mandatory bovine tuberculosis testing, a ruse the quack Baker charged, for meatpackers to acquire cheaper beef. When the standoff escalated into outbursts of actual barnyard violence, Iowa Governor Dan Turner called on the state's militia to squelch a rebellion. 50 veterinarians, all working in pairs while being protected by armed soldiers, gave injections to 5,000 cattle per day for a week, putting an end to the spread of a disease that caused cows to have spontaneous abortions before the disease spread nationwide and fucked up all of America's beef industry. Baker was quickly becoming a real pain in the ass for law enforcement, and in 1931, the Federal Radio Commission shut down his KTNT station for continually spreading dangerous misinformation. He was like a Alex Jones type dude. Then a year later, Baker went to a federal court in Davenport to settle a libel suit he had filed against the American Medical Association for calling him a quack, a faker, and a charlatan. When the jury sided with the American Medical Association because Baker was, in fact, a quack, a faker, and a charlatan, Baker sought redress through what else but politics. He entered the race for Iowa's governor as a write-in candidate on the farm labor ticket, but campaigned from Nuevo Laredo, Mexico, where he had constructed a 100,000-watt radio station to replace KTNT in a nation with very little regulation when it came to quackery at the time. Ever the showman, Baker sent campaign trucks rolling through Iowa counties with colorful banners, loudspeakers, blaring speeches, and, of course, Caliphone carnival music. Hell yeah. Nothing drums up votes like this. Despite his efforts, He only got around 5,000 votes on Election Day. The winner, Clyde Herring, received over 508,000 votes. The runner-up, Dan Turner, received roughly 455,000 votes. So 5,000, just a bit outside, just a bit short of what he needed. Not exactly a number that made Baker a real political upstart to be reckoned with. Despite that abysmal failure, Baker would try again, returning to Iowa in 1936 to enter Iowa's U.S. senatorial race as a Republican, where he finished fifth in the primary. All this led to more bad press. And after RKO Radio Pictures discredited his Muscatine Hospital in a March of Time newsreel, a lot of people are fucking pissed about this guy, rightfully so. That was one of the most prominent forms of journalism at the time. Baker shut it down and relocated to Eureka Springs, Arkansas, where citizens of the now depressed resort town welcomed the embattled entrepreneur as a possible economic savior. In 1937, he used the blood money he had made selling snake oil to cancer patients to purchase the Crescent Hotel. He had grand plans to turn it into the Baker Hospital. He painted the building a garish shade of purple, emblazoned signs on the exterior proclaiming it to be the cancer-curable Baker Hospital. For fuck's sake. Inside, he crowded the lobby with random official-looking medical equipment, makeshift exam rooms, and operating theaters. And with his background in radio, he now relaunched himself as the Ozarks miracle worker, declaring, quote, "Come to the Ozarks and be healed. The Baker Hospital guarantees recovery without the knife, without pain." Now, there'll be a lot of pain. Sadly, desperate and dying patients began arriving in droves at the former hotel with literally zero fucking licensed doctors on staff. Not one. Patients were subjected to daily injections of his miracle cure. One nurse would later say, quote, "We were not allowed to question the treatments or express concern. We were told to simply smile and keep the patients calm, even when it was clear they were suffering." So evil. This did little to reassure patients or their families. In 1938, one woman wrote, "My mother is getting worse, not better. Dr. Baker insists it's part of the process, but I see her suffering and I'm losing hope." Another letter, this one to Baker, pleaded, "My wife is in agony. There is no improvement, only more pain." And now here's a full letter from a patient named Luther J. Baggett, a cancer patient. He wrote this letter to his wife and three young kids back in Arizona. This poor family, they had used all their savings to send Luther to Arkansas, hoping Dr. Baker could miraculously save his life. But instead, of course, he just got grifted. He dated this letter Friday, December 9th, 1938. "My dear little bunch, the weather has blowed off nice and has been a pretty day. Me and another old man walked to town this afternoon, but I haven't had any mail from home yet. This is an awful out-of-way place. Out-of-way place, and mail is slow getting in and out, but I will surely get something tomorrow. I wrote to Floyd and Vera McClure at High, Texas today. We'll mail this tomorrow. I have wrote you two letters already. Oneida, can you send me Holt's address? I sure would like to kiss my wife, big girl, little girl, and my sonny boy. Good night." And then he added, Saturday morning the 10th, before he sent it, "Have been pretty busy up to now. Castor oil at 6, tonic at 7, shaved, went to breakfast, took needle treatment back to room on bed with hot pack, have just got back from a little walk and some air, yes, and had carrot juice at 9. They say that all the medicines and food used here are made from vegetables, herbs, roots, and bark. Can't tell you yet what they're going to do with my main trouble." You know, he's talking about the cancer, of course. "But they sure seem to work over your blood and system. They didn't find much the matter with me. My blood was 30 points low in my main trouble. Some people come here and they find several ailments that they didn't know they had." Yeah, because this is all bullshit. "That makes it more expensive. One man came just ahead of me with several ailments, and they charged him $500 flat rate for 5 weeks treatment without room. Some are saving some money rooming out, but they wanted me here in the hospital. It seems that most of them has to stay as much as 5 weeks and some longer since the mail seems so slow. You had better let me know soon how you think we are going to get along financially. Guess I will try to stay the 3 weeks. If I don't stay any longer, I have $47 now. It will take $3 more for next week, $50 for the next, and about $30 for a ticket and a little for laundry. About 90 more for 3 weeks. This sure has been a long week for me, and since I haven't had a letter and wondering if some of you are bad sick, I'm going to try and write to Mammy today, and I am not sure of her address. Well, the last mail has come for the week, and I didn't get a letter. Don't know what to do. Think, and it seems there's nothing I can do about it. We'll quit and get this in the mail. Love to all. LJB. Luther would die in agony 2 months after he sent that letter. Many patients died. Well, at the Crescent, nearly all of them did. Hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands. Any records regarding the totality of death were either lost or destroyed. Baker definitely treated thousands of desperate patients with his bullshit injections. Reportedly, Baker accumulated hundreds of thousands of dollars, which he kept in various safe deposits known only to him and his accomplice, a woman named Thelma Yount. Postal inspectors will claim that the hospital cleared about $500,000 in just the first full year of operation. And to deal with all the dead bodies, and that's millions in today's dollars, and to deal with all the dead bodies of people Baker made his money off of, dead bodies that were bad for business, Baker created a makeshift morgue in the basement, where bodies were stored before being quietly removed from the premises in ways both legal and illegal. All this made for an atmosphere that careened between insane, false optimism and the slow, relentless creep of death, a mind-bending place where nobody's judgment was treated as legitimate unless you were Dr. Baker. In 1939, a concerned and outraged reporter wrote, "The Crescent Hotel has become a house of horrors, where false hope is sold at a high price, and the dying are giving nothing more than pain and empty promises." It was another article said, "A place where people went to die." By the close of the decade, authorities began to investigate, and in 1940, the federal government stepped in. Baker was arrested, charged with mail fraud, since he had been accepting payments via the U.S. Postal Service. That was all they could fucking get him with. Thankfully, Baker was tried and convicted of that, but he only received a 4-year prison sentence. He was incarcerated in Leavenworth Penitentiary, approximately 25 miles northwest of Kansas City, Kansas. Upon his release, he faded into obscurity, living his remaining years off the coast of Florida in a boat formerly owned by the railroad baron Jay Gould until his death in 1958 at the age of 75. Damn. Never served any real justice, got to live on a boat in beautiful, sunny, warm waters, that piece of shit. Of course, he left the Crescent Hotel abandoned again in his wake. Now a maze of once stately features, dusty rooms, medical refuse, as well as what became known as the Death Tunnel, a.k.a. the morgue. Some tried to rehabilitate the hotel in the decades that followed, with ownership passing from various individuals, with fleeting ambitions to restore the property, but nothing stuck. Instead, it became a reported hotbed for paranormal experiences, with one local historian claiming in 1960 that on a walk through the ballroom, he and others began to hear disembodied music being played. A group of teenagers who snuck into the property in 1967 claimed they heard a door slam upstairs, even though they had checked every room and found the hotel to definitively be empty. And many more claims, much more intense claims, were made. I'll share some here in a bit. In 1997, Marty and Elise Rennick, a couple with a passion for historic preservation, purchased the building. They embarked on an ambitious restoration, restoration project that aimed to return the Crescent to its former glory. No small task. Workers encountered crumbling walls, extensive structural damage, broken windows, overgrown grounds, but they also found artifacts few people ever get to see firsthand. Fragments of original stained glass, intricate woodwork, faded wallpaper hand-painted for the hotel's original opening. The restoration would also lead to more ghost stories. Several workers claimed that their tools disappeared and that they heard footsteps in empty hallways, or that they felt somebody walking up behind them only to turn around and see nothing. One electrician claimed to see a thick fog in the morgue that faded into the wall as he watched. Still, the work on the hotel continued, and the Crescent reopened its doors as a hotel in 1997 and quickly became a popular attraction. Not necessarily a place of luxury anymore, but a cool old building beloved by those with an appreciation for history. The Rennicks embraced the hotel's haunted atmosphere, incorporating tales of apparitions, unexplained phenomena, and tragic deaths into its marketing, including a story about a stonemason named Michael plummeting to his death in 1886. According to the story, Michael was a young Irish stonemason tasked with building a portion of the hotel's imposing edifice. He was a skilled craftsman, but ultimately lost his balance while leaning over the edge of a window, trying to impress a young woman he wanted to, date. Apparently, he landed in the spot that would one day become Room 218. Perhaps based on the effectiveness of the marketing, or perhaps not, guests found themselves having inexplicable experiences in this room now. One woke up to watch the bathroom door swing open and then swing back shut completely on its own. "Definitely not alone in here," they wrote. Room 218 quickly gained notoriety as the most haunted room in the hotel, with guests reporting flickering lights, objects moving on their own, and even being touched by unseen hands. The dining room became a hot spot for encounters as well. Staff reported hearing clinking glasses and silverware after the area had been closed for the night, or hearing the piano play on its own. Weirdly enough, the laundry also surfaced as a place of mystery. Staff would find linens folded neatly one moment, scattered around the next. One woman even reported seeing a lady in Victorian dress walk by and then disappear into thin air as she was working on some laundry. The hotel leaned into the economic opportunity all of these ghost sightings provided, and the hotel became a popular spot for ghost tours led by guides dressed in period clothing. These in turn caught the attention of paranormal investigators who descended on the property with recording devices, electromagnetic field detectors, infrared cameras, etc. The hotel was featured in a 2005 episode of Ghost Hunters, where some team members claimed to see a full-body apparition melt into a wall. Marty Rennick, one of the owners, would die in a car crash in 2009, sadly, and Elise, his widow, remains the hotel's current owner. In 2016, the building was placed on the National Register of Historic Places. In 2022, it won the Historic Hotels of America Lifetime Achievement Award. And before I share a bit more paranormal lore, the hotel is not Eureka Springs' only interesting feature today. Based on the many lives of the hotel and, just how weird people seem to be comfortable being in Eureka, others have tried to launch their own, sometimes interesting, ventures. In 1964, Christian nationalist Gerald K. Smith, known for his anti-Semitic, white supremacist, far-right extremist views, began building a religious theme park named Sacred Projects, proposed to include a life-size recreation of Jerusalem. That never fully developed. That was ambitious. But two of the components are major city-defining projects today: the seven-story Christ of the Ozarks statue, designed by Emmett Sullivan, and the nearby The Great Passion play performed during the summer. This play is regularly performed from May through October by a cast of 170 actors and dozens of live animals. Thankfully, the script of The Great Passion play has been altered from its original script, which set Jesus' beatings at Herod's court and included a monologue blaming his death on the hateful, horrible Jews. Since it's been put on, it has been seen by an estimated 7.7 million people, which make it the largest attended outdoor drama in the U.S., according to the Institute of Outdoor Theater of the University of East Carolina. Other Christian-themed attractions have been added in association with the drama production, including a new Holy Land tour that features a full-scale recreation of the tabernacle in the wilderness, i.e. the portable tent where the Israelites gathered in the desert. Other attractions include a section of the Berlin Wall, and a Bible museum featuring more than 6,000 different Bibles, including an original 1611 King James Bible, which is historically, very interesting. Eureka Springs is not only made up of imaginative Christians, though. Throughout the 1960s and 70s, comfort with getting weird attracted many members of the hippie movement and lesbian separatists, lesbians who wanted to live completely separate of men. The accepting environment fostered a network of gay and lesbian business owners, and the town became known as a resort town for LGBTQIA+ tourism, in addition to being a popular draw for Christian fundamentalists, which is unusual mashup, but they worked it out. Eureka Springs became the first city in Arkansas to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples back in 2014. So while the Crescent Hotel is mostly known for being, as its marketing dubs it, America's most haunted hotel, I don't think that's the main takeaway here. Maybe the main takeaway is that a weirdo who started a hospital in a cave, Dr. Alva Jackson, accidentally set in motion a long tradition of establishments that straddle the line between entertainment, spirituality, and just a place to be weird or, sometimes dangerous. Sometimes it's been for economic gain or to spread misinformation like Norman Baker or the fossilized baby hoax or Gerald K. Smith's prejudice and harmful beliefs. But other times, the ones that seem to have stuck around the longest, it's been motivated by a genuine appreciation for a landscape and all its majestic mysteriousness and a culture of historically isolated community deep in the Arkansas Mountains, an area known for conservatism, but with a large population of liberals as well. Getting along, what seems to unite them, is a belief that keeping your mind open is one of the most interesting and fun ways to live, as exemplified by the town's yearly Halloween zombie crawl, its Nightmare in the Ozarks Film Festival, its Mardi Gras extravaganza, and the town even hosts an annual UFO conference. Would the world be a better place if we all lived a little like they do in Eureka Springs? If we didn't drink the Kool-Aid, but instead quenched our thirst with some refreshing, minerally spring water? Fuck yeah. Okay, now, as promised, let's share some scared-to-death style paranormal claims before I exit. Everything you've heard so far has been, you know, pretty heavily sourced. Everything going forward has not. While I'm not sure any of it is true, I also don't know that it's not true. Might be true. And that's a fun space to play with for an October episode. Circling back to Dr. Baker's treatments, the doctor who was not a doctor, he was able to destroy or hide most of the records of what he had done. There are rumors that he did quite a bit of experimentation when it came to his snake oil injections of his cure-all elixir of ground-up clover, corn silk, and watermelon seeds mixed with water. He reportedly injected this mixture into some of his patients' eyeballs and into small holes he had drilled into their skulls, which killed them. Truly some mad scientist shit. He supposedly had one wing of the building sealed off, labeling it as a psychiatric ward, where patients fucking crying out in pain from his treatments would be sequestered away from prying eyes so they didn't deter additional people from being conned and tortured and possibly murdered. He experimented with reckless abandon, and when someone eventually died, or he just straight up, you know, fucking killed them directly with his shit, Norman then disposed of them by shoving them down a chute where the corpses piled up in the basement disposal room near the morgue. No bodies were ever taken into the morgue during the day because the clinic claimed to have a 100% success rate. Instead, at night, a nurse would arrive and one by one place each dead body on a gurney, wheel it down to the morgue. She was the only one allowed to be in this portion of the building at night. The only sound that filled the halls would be the creaking of her gurney as it rolled down the halls and the thump sound of another body hitting the slab. And today, nearly a century after she moved the body, some guests claim to still hear her make her walk and dump off bodies. Supposedly, this typically happens starting around 11 or 11:30 at night. Some claim to hear the creaking of her gurney as it rolls down the hallway, the shuffling footsteps following it. Sometimes they even report feeling the tug of a hand on their foot as they sleep, as though the nurse has mistaken them for a dead body and is trying to drag them off to the morgue. Sometimes they say they hear a quiet chuckle. Some guests have claimed to hear her speak, to say stuff like, "You're a heavy one, aren't you? Easy, ghost." And when they open their eyes from their comfort or perhaps discomfort of their hotel bed, some have claimed to actually see her, an older, solidly built woman with gray hair and flat, dead eyes, leaning over them, wearing a little white cap, a neatly pressed uniform, and no name tag. Other guests of the hotel are reported coming back to the rooms after a night of local sightseeing and fine dining, only to see apparitions like what appears to be an 80-year-old woman in front of room 419 searching for her key. "Do you have my key?" she'll ask the guests, and then she will disappear into a wall. Other guests are reported coming back to their rooms to find the luggage they had unpacked piled back into their open suitcase, flung in haphazardly as if something or someone is trying to tell them to get the fuck out. One time, a repairman left his tools in the basement. Then he popped back down to quickly grab them before heading out for the night. And he claimed that as he descended down the stairs, all of a sudden, all of the washers and all of the dryers came on simultaneously, rocking back and forth, flashing the lights on their displays. On another occasion in the morning, a cook, Steve, was slicing vegetables for that night's dinner when he said all the pots flew off their hooks and crashed to the floor, but none of them touched him. In fact, the pots and pans made a perfect circle around him. Owner Elise Rennick said she hired two mediums, Ken Fugate and Carol Heath, to read the building, and that the mediums came to believe that the Crescent Hotel contained a portal, quote, to the other side, to a dimension that holds the spirits of the dead, that can be accessed by those, quote, on the same frequency as ghosts. This is what Elise said made her decide to start offering ghost tours. And she now claims that she has seen numerous tour groups experience the unexplainable. For example, in one of the doorways, over and over, she said a few guests in nearly every group that she watched would suddenly turn pale. Some even fell against and slid down the wall in a faint. When Elise asked her hotel manager, Ken, why he thought this was happening, Ken remembered that the doorway was the specific place that the mediums had identified as this supposed portal. The doorway directly above Norman Baker's former morgue. Could those mediums be right? Could there be portals to the world of the dead? Do certain places make it easier to access the world of the no longer living? Did what Dr. Baker did to so many poor dying people turn the former Crescent Hotel into some kind of magnet for the restless dead? I don't know. I have no idea what happens to any of us when we die. But I will say, after recording nearly 400 episodes of Scared to Death, when you add up the bonus episodes as well, while I still don't claim to know what happens when we die, you know, we might just be worm food, maybe we have a spirit or a soul that lives on in some form. I do think this life is not the end. Might be the end of us existing in our current form. Might be the end of our personality, our memories, our ego. Might not. We might move on to some other place, as ourselves, some other space. Or at least that might be possible, and it also might be possible that some of us, for whatever reason, do not move on, but instead we get stuck for a while. Lost in places, generally places of strong emotion, places of despair, confusion, torment, and death. Places like Eureka Springs' former Crescent Hotel. And that's it for this edition of Time Suck, Short Sucks. I hope you enjoyed a little bit of October escapism. A lot of interesting shit happened in that town. Maybe some paranormal stuff's happening there right now. If you did enjoy this story, check out the rest of the Bad Magic catalog. Beefier episodes of Time Suck every Monday at noon Pacific time. New episodes of the now long-running paranormal podcast, Scared to Death, Tuesdays at midnight. With two episodes of Nightmare Fuel, fictional horror written by myself, thrown into the mix each month. Thanks to Sophie Evans for her initial research. Thanks to Logan Keith polishing up the sound of today's episode, making the nice episode thumbnail artwork. Please go to badmagicproductions.com for all your bad magic needs. Have yourself a great weekend.
Bad Magic Productions.